Well, welcome to Simple Super. And I guess we now move to the panel discussion, and for parts of Nicole's address that you want expanded, she'll be on the panel. So other members of the panel, could they please come up? David and... Well, as well as two of the speakers this afternoon, we're now joined by two further panellists. First one, it seems very odd to even need an introduction for Barry Dunstan. So many of us, when he writes in the Financial Review, that's the first page we go to read what he's saying. But Barry is an associate editor and columnist at the Australian Financial Review, where he's been writing on superannuation, investments and funds management topics since 1987. Since joining the Review, Barry has specialised in covering the superannuation industry and regularly travels overseas to talk with major fund managers. He has written several investment books, including the latest one, The New Art of Investment, aimed at small share investors. So, welcome, Barry. And we're also very fortunate that joining us on the panel is Joanne Block, who's the Chief Executive Officer, Financial Planning Association of Australia. Joanne has extensive experience in the financial services sector in Australia, having worked in the area of superannuation, financial planning, funds management and life insurance. Until June of this year, Joanne was based in the UK as a principal with Mercer HR Services. There's that connection again. For whom she established a new pension service. Joanne has held roles with Investment and Financial Services Association, NSP Buck, Mellon, Macquarie Bank, Sedgwick Noble Lowndes and Mercer here in Australia, National Mutual and the New South Wales Government. So please welcome Joanne. And before we move more formally to the panel discussion, where you've got the opportunity to ask questions, I'll give Barry and Joanne the opportunity to maybe make a few comments on either what comments on what they've heard today, or just any comments of relevance to the new super landscape. So, Barry, would you like to say a few words first?
Thanks, Mark. I just wanted to throw a couple of little minor hand grenades in the door, really. I wonder if we will the expected inflow into superannuation really make a big difference in the public offer funds area? We know that the new money is going to come in. I wonder, though, whether a lot of this new inflow might be concentrated in self-managed super funds rather than in public offer funds. We know where most of the high net worth money is going. It seems to me the self-managed funds are about tax as well as and estate planning. I couldn't beat Michael Rice's $50 million in a self-managed fund, but I have heard of two amounts in the high teens in self-managed funds, and it seems to me these are more than just providing for retirement income. I think that perhaps there are two other things we ought to look at. The ANAP survey, which ASFA had done the other week, suggests that there were still a lot of people who remain to be convinced, despite the work that the actuaries have done, that these changes are going to be permanent. This is too good to be true sort of view. And I just wonder whether that plus and the view that we get a lot of changes in superannuation, this is just another case of it, even though that feeling is perhaps not really important, it's still apparent there, I think. And I just wonder whether that will reduce the percentage of people initially likely to put more money into super, because we know that the people who are on lower incomes are not as keen to put money in. They're not putting any money in. And I think the last factor that worries me is the potential disincentive from the threatened increase in the contribution tax over this wretched tax file number business. It's effectively the surcharge for the low-income earner. And I just, if the, we know the surcharge had a big effect on high net worth people's super contributions, I wonder what effective surcharge is going to have on low income people. I'm sorry to be so negative, but I just thought I'd throw these in. Joanne?
Thanks, Barry.
Well, at least you didn't throw in commissions, Barry, so there's a good start. Or might you get to that later?
I'll let you.
Oh, good, okay. Thank you, Martin. It's great to be here, and I'm sorry I haven't been here for the rest of the day, although it looks like it was a great agenda. I guess, having sat through part of Nicole's presentation, advice is more critical now than ever. Planners are going to be very busy. They have embraced the changes, contrary to the Treasurer's comments at the time, and of course he has retracted those comments. But I guess the issue that the FPA has is that this is still very much applicable to the high net worth individual, and we still do have a problem getting to accessible and affordable advice for those people who probably do need it, but may it be at the other end of the spectrum. And so we're arguing very strongly in government at the moment at the whole compliance regime, and we're looking at the fact that we really need to bring advice into the realms of people who do need it. And clearly there are a number of people who don't need it, and that will always be the case. But if you look at super switching, and if you look at what's going on in that area, there is a need for advice, and the cost of the statements of advice, the research that's required, and the complications involved has really put advice out of the realms of a lot of people, and that is a big problem. So let's not forget that as an area that we do need to look at. I guess the other point is that while super is really important, advisors need to look at everyone's at an individual's entire circumstances, and I think that's pretty important too. And our recent advertising campaign was very much about the fact that advice goes well beyond super, and that is really critical. Super is important, assets are increasing, baby boomers are about to retire, it's on everyone's agenda, but it isn't the be-all and end-all. There are other strategies to achieving your financial goals. I'm glad to see you nodding. And there are real issues going on out there in the community with debt. We need to start looking at reverse mortgages and all sorts of issues around that and various other things. So let's not lose sight of that as well. I guess most importantly also it is about confidence in the system. And I agree, Barry, that whilst we've embraced the announcements, people are a little bit sceptical that Labor will come in, for example, and change what's happened. Now, Nick Sherry at the FPA conference last week said that Labor is pretty supportive of the government's changes and announcements, and in fact the only things they were thinking of were things like banning exit fees and so forth. Having said that, though, and knowing Labor and policies of the past, we know that commissions mandating default options, mandating a much higher super guarantee number and so forth are potentially on their agenda, as is a different tax regime. So I hope that Labor does take a bipartisan approach. I do think that is a really big issue. But in the meantime, I guess, you know, we have to embrace and get on with it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Barry and Joanne. Now, any questions or comments to any or all members of the panel?
Just to kick it off and make sure we are a panel, perhaps I might reflect on a couple of comments that Barry and Joanne have made. The tax file number and the disincentive issue for low-income earners, I think, is a real sleeper. In fact, it's not a sleeper. It's awake and is a concern, because we talked about confidence in the system, and that low-income earners, middle-income earners need confidence in the system. And if they get taxed at the highest marginal tax rate on the contributions because the tax file number's not there, confidence will be lost. And so I think it's a really important issue that... it's not easy to solve, because many funds don't have tax file numbers of all their members. And so we have a question mark there in terms of, will that threaten some of the community confidence in the whole system? I think Joan indirectly raised a question as to who has benefit out of all these changes. And predominantly, it's the high-income earner. The low and middle-income earners have gained very little out of this change at the moment. And again, that's a concern. Again, that threatens the confidence. And one of the difficult messages coming out of the changes is it better to salary sacrifice or put your own money in and get the co-contribution? At the low-income end, co-contribution is beneficial. At the high-income end, it's salary sacrifice. And that is a very mixed message to give when in the middle, it's neither. So in terms of communication to members by funds, there are some very sophisticated messages that one needs to get out, because some individuals will be moving from low income to high income back to low income in certain years, so for a variety of reasons. So there are mixed messages that are not straightforward to get out. And I can't resist responding to Barry's question as to will all the inflow go into self-managed super funds. I suspect in the second quarter next year, when we will get the $1 million dollops, a fair chunk of it will. I think longer term, though, all funds will receive extra dollars, whether that be salary sacrifice or undeducted contributions. So I think there'll be a whole lot more money going into super. Second quarter next year, a fair bit of it will be self-managed super funds, but by no means all. I'm aware of many other funds who will receive some of that money.
Just from today's discussion, I've got one area of concern. Like this morning we spoke about increasing retirement age because the country can't afford to pay pensions. Then Nicole just mentioned how the change in the asset test would cost the government a lot of money. I think we seem to be not looking at where the real problem is, which is in the low-income area, or where the needs is. And there seems to be a lot of concentration on the fact that there are a lot of people who can actually afford to do all this anyway, so we really shouldn't be so worried about them. But we haven't really worried about people who, one, kind of don't have enough money to retire or even to live on, and don't have enough income to save towards retirement. So I just find it a bit of a contradiction.
It is a concern, and I sort of hinted at that a bit in my talk. But just a funny thing that happened to me, like, after budget night, the very next day, I was pretty tired because it was a late night, and the very next day I had an advisor call me and say, but how's the government going to afford all the people that are going to be on the healthcare card? So I was like, okay, so you've processed the RBL going, you've processed more people get age pension, and now you're worried about ancillary benefits, which was quite amazing that this planner had thought all that through. It's the extra cost of Social Security and the extra cost of all the ancillary benefits. I mean, we hope that's all factored in to the projections. But, yeah, I agree with your point that it's not really giving a lot to people who most need it. Getting rid of tax on super, well, that's great, but a lot of people aren't paying tax on benefits because their balance is lower than the post-83 tax-free threshold anyway. So you're actually not giving concessions to people that perhaps need it the most. So it's a bit of a problem.
I guess the other thing is that there's still a very considerable retirement savings gap, whichever way you look at it as well. So, all the issues like literacy and education come into play, better education, and this is one of the issues that we're also talking to government about in terms of better defining general and personal advice and being able to provide limited advice on a scalable level and so forth. And these are the sorts of things that are causing some issues in our ability or the FPA's members' ability to deliver advice at that level. Super funds are trying very hard to deliver education and general advice and in some cases personal advice to try and deal with these issues, but all they have at the moment is co-contributions and the desperate need to encourage people to put more than 9% in, which a lot of people don't have. So it is a real problem. So our mantra, if you like, is that you need to manage your 9% very well as well. You need to have it in strategies that aren't default strategies. I was quoted as saying that the FPA wants to ban default funds. That was a little dramatic. We are very concerned that in some funds, 99% of members go into default funds, not because they choose it, but because they don't choose. Is that appropriate? Now, in many cases, the default funds are fine, but in many cases, that isn't necessarily the case, and I think we need to watch that as well. And I'm not advocating advice for the sake of it either, but let's look at you know, how we can make the 9% go further if that's all you've got.
Martin, could I just pull together a couple of points that occurred to me as we were talking about this? The feeling that the lower paid or lower income people still haven't done very well out of super suggests, of course, that traditionally you'd think that the ALP would be the politicians that would worry about this from a social equity point of view. And yet, I must say, despite what Joanne was saying, the impression I got from hearing the politicians talk at ASFA was that Nick Sherry was going out of his way to say that he wasn't going to make any changes. He said he wasn't minded to change any existing legislation at all. He's ruled out any legislative increase in the SG. But, you know, you have to start wondering what the rest of the party might be thinking if this, this wave starts building up that, you know, it's time for the for the workers to get a little more concentration. So I suspect Sherry is going out of his way to say this to calm down the idea that Labor would change. But I just wonder, you know, I suspect there might be political pressure there from others in the party. In fact, it seemed to me from the ASFA conference that Grant Chapman was more keen about making changes than Nick Sherry was. But I'll leave that one.
Just to follow up the need for higher savings rates amongst the low to middle income earners, Cathy this morning mentioned what I will call soft compulsion, the opportunity to members to opt out of member contributions. We're going to see that in New Zealand with the Kiwi Saver. We're likely to see it in the UK with their reforms. We're seeing it to some extent slightly differently in the US with automatic enrolment. Those sorts of default strategies, when you're in unless you opt out, I suspect we will start to see in Australia in a matter of years, not in the next couple of months. But they're a way of increasing savings at the low to middle income end. But if you desperately need the money, and some low income earners do desperately need it, then you don't have to do it. But a member contribution of starting at 1%, gradually increasing to 2 or 3 on an opt-out strategy, I think is one way of gradually increasing the level of super savings.
Alan Doble. My question is primarily to David, but others might have a view as well. I was interested in the case you made for building up reserves or capital in superannuation funds, which I thought you did a good job of putting the fear of God in us, I suppose. There were two questions. The first one, I think, pretty simple. You'd illustrated a 0.7% reserve. Why 0.7? Second one, I think, is a bit harder. I'll use the fund that I'm in as an example. The trust deed requires, it's accumulation plan defined contribution. The fund requires full distribution of earnings after the cost of investment expenses. The fund deducts exactly the correct amount of insurance premium as paid, and the employer picks up the other expenses of the fund. There doesn't seem to be any room there to build up a reserve other than if a change of the trust deed was made to allow that. And it, you could possibly make a case that that's to the benefit of members, but I would have thought that it's a difficult case to make and might have some legal questions. Would you have a view on how you might achieve that and if it's necessary? Or maybe this is a case if you just say the members bear whatever comes out.
Thank you, Alan, for those two good questions. Even the first one's not straightforward. Why did I pick 0.7? I'll tackle that one first. The reason I chose 0.7, I think you could go probably as high as 1%, much beyond 1%. I think there would be some inequity arguments that perhaps become more pronounced. The reason I chose 0.7 was I think there's an argument to members to say, if I take 0.1%, 0.15% each year, that's a reasonable amount that I can justify to build up a reserve that doesn't hurt the investment earnings too much this year. Clearly, if I cut it by 1% a year, to be extreme, then it's hurting members a lot. So it's a it's a balance number, it's an equity balance number, if you like, between generations. So that's why I chose 0.7. There's no magic number here. I think 1% in a total reserve is reasonable for very big funds. It's probably 0.5%, but built up over 5 years. Your second question, of course, the scenario you painted was a little bit different from probably the scenario I was assuming. You have an employer fund there where the employer is seemingly paying the admin costs. You have a deed. The question then arises in my mind, what responsibility does the employer have or is willing to bear should these operational risk events occur? Clearly, the deed doesn't permit a reserve to be built up, as you explained it. My question is, what responsibility is the employer willing to accept in that scenario? If the answer is no, then of course the members are bearing it all.
Yes.
David, it's Kevin O'Sullivan again. In following on from that question, if I'm a member in a choice fund environment, if I'm willing to accept the risk that I'm in a fund that doesn't have a reserve, why wouldn't I just say, I'll move to a fund that isn't taking 0.1% out of my account every year, in 5 years' time, move back into this fund, have this insurance?
Kevin, you're a sophisticated member. our evidence with fund choice, I think across the industry, is very few members are exercising fund choice. Yes, we're seeing some members consolidating, some members changing funds when they change employers, but a very small percentage of members are exercising fund choice. I think we would be doing members as a whole more service by looking at the long-term sustainability of the fund I'm in for the 98% of members who aren't going to switch, so that they're not hurt by an operational risk event. Yes, there might be a small number of members who move out, but 0.1%, am I going to move funds? I suspect not.
Well, I might ask a question of Joanne. And it's apparent from Nicole's presentation that financial planners are going to be extraordinarily busy this year and doing the sort of thing perhaps they have been doing. But beyond 1 July 2007, do you see the industry changing, perhaps with more emphasis on strategic advice to clients rather than the tax environment, or do you still see pretty much a continuation of the current way of operation?
I think it's always changing, that you can be certain. They are getting into more sophisticated strategies, embracing more holistic areas. We started with super and investments, and we're moving into debt management and all sorts of other areas. So I think the opportunities are enormous. I think, quite frankly, the problem is we don't have enough people in the industry to service the demand. The demand is huge at the moment. It's going to increase at all levels. So I think that's the big issue. But certainly it's becoming more strategic, and certainly you're seeing changing business models. On the one hand, some areas are becoming simpler, others are becoming more complex. You've got a whole array of different issues to choose from. There's always something new to think about. I don't imagine the government in any way, shape or form is also going to sit still. There might be a calm next year because there's an election, but then after that there's always changes that you expect. The system isn't perfect, so you're always going to be dealing with different issues. The skill shortage is probably the most critical aspect that we face at the moment.
Andrew Gale. It's quite often the case that legislation and rules have precisely the opposite effect of what was intended. The minimum wage legislation was brought in 1928 to protect the underskilled, and the first thing that happened was that employers, when the minimum wage was brought in, sacked those people because they believed that they weren't worth the minimum wage, and it actually wasn't to their benefit in the short term, at least. With the current compliance regime for advice, it's got some fairly demanding type requirements. There's been some discussion today about what are we doing for those in the low to middle segment. So, yes, those who have got reasonable investable assets or a high net worth or whatever, There's an advice regime there which covers the big risk is that those in the low to middle segment are going to be denied advice around, you know, optimisation type strategies. So I'm interested in the views, I guess, from each person on the panel in terms of, you know, looking in the medium term, what reasonably can or should be done to address the low to middle segment, especially around advice provision, and something where it makes sense that in terms of, you know, that there's reasonable advice given, but it's obviously on an economic and commercial basis, which makes some sense to providers.
Thank you for the question. I could just bring out the tape recorder. I think the big issue is documentation and compliance appropriate to the requirement at hand. And week before last, the government, through its FSR refinements, made some changes and announced a threshold, a record of advice rather than a statement of advice for amounts less than $10,000. But of course it excluded super. Now, that would have been fantastic if it included super, because in fact the demand is that the super level, where people are looking at amalgamating their super funds or looking at advice at that level. Now, the question is whether $10,000 is worth it or not. We advocated a slightly higher amount, between 15 and 25. But the level of documentation, we did a case study, this is real, financial advisor talking to a client with 8 super funds, account balance in total of $20,000. Client wants to amalgamate because there's bits everywhere. 20 hours worth of work, $4,500. Total account balance, $20,000. Ridiculous situation. Advisor walks away from it. Client says, "Are you mad?" And this is just upfront advice, strategic advice. So this is the sort of situation that we're faced with at the moment. Unfortunately, superannuation is a hot potato, and the government is keeping it out of the fray. In terms of providing some form of relief from a compliance perspective, they say it's because it's actually a long-term investment, but in fact I'm pretty convinced that it's a political issue and it's very difficult to deal with super. But the government has also said it's receptive to submissions, and obviously we'll be arguing that case. I think the other thing is that in some cases the product providers provide very good advice, very good access to education, and people should avail themselves of that and go and talk to people where it's either free or part of the service or however they want to access it. There is actually now quite a good range of advice that's available across the board. So we need to encourage people to avail themselves of the advice, and therein lies the FPA's campaign on the value of advice and why it's important and what it can do for you. So it's a long journey. It's not something that I think Australians will want to do. I don't think people lie in bed at night and think, "Oh, I think I need advice tomorrow." I think there are things that trigger it, redundancy, for example, pre-retirement. But we're not getting people thinking about their future planning and those sorts of issues. And in fact, you talk about irony. I think the fact that the 9% super guarantee is in place has also stopped people from thinking about it. It's an automatic entitlement. It's there. And do people really think beyond that because they know they've got an amount there? So a number of things we could be doing. And I'll shut up.
There is a problem, of course, that we know the problem. If people need advice, how can we get it to them in an affordable way? And it seems that at the moment that's got to include them paying commissions or fee or trailing fees. And it just seems to me that the way into this may be to put more, to give the superannuation funds themselves greater opportunity to give advice to their own members without being caught up in some of the things that they currently fear. Because it seems to me that apart from the people at the upper end can get and afford advice, the people in the middle and the lower end can't afford it. But I query sometimes whether they need, you know, ongoing advice or a yearly review. If they're putting what they can into superannuation and they're in a well-run, relatively cheaply, a cheap fee fund, you know, what more do they need to be told except to sort of keep at it for a while until you've got enough money? Because, you know, the one thing I think is, what the one thing everyone knows in investment is, if you start fiddling with something, you're really going to muck it up and it's going to cost yourself a lot of money. So, you know, I think there can be too much advice if we're getting down at the lower end of the market.
This feels like the hot potato. I think there is an opportunity in this space, and I think it's a real problem, to set up a structure where people can have contained advice in respect of super only and not the full know your client position. There are probably three or four fundamental questions that most members want to know about super. They relate to things about, should I consolidate? Should I salary sacrifice or contribute my own money? What's member in choice, member investment choice mean? And maybe transition to retirement, although I'd put that as a bit more complicated. But in terms of members under 55, there are three or four, and I might have left one other out, fundamental issues. And I think there is an opportunity, if the government wants to amend the appropriate legislation, to say a fund or an advisor or somebody can provide this advice within these constraints. It is not full financial advice about your whole situation. It's only about super. The other item I forgot was insurance. But within that, those constraints, I think we would have an opportunity to perhaps simplify it.
Just quickly, my comments are that, like, for your middle income, so your low income earners will, I mean, they don't have a lot to spare anyway, so. But for your middle income earners, like, one of the good things about the changes is, like, if you were paying 31.5% tax and instead you were thinking put in deductible contributions, so lose 15 on the way in and 15 on the way out, and now it's 15 on the way in and nothing on the way out, you can see, like, it's pretty clear that that's a pretty good deal. So that, you know, that's good for people on 31.5, which there's more people on that bracket now that the brackets have moved. In that bracket, there's also the co-contribution, which is fantastic for people that can access it. And, like, that is being taken up quite a lot, you know, which is good news. So there is some good news for people in that area. But obviously there's a lot of issues as well. And that's my comment on that.
Thanks very much. That seems like a good place to end. It's gone after five o'clock, and that was a question where all the panel could contribute. So could we first of all thank the panel for their efforts in talking and answering questions. Thank you. And there will be an opportunity to talk to the panel over drinks. Well, as we said right at the start, the superannuation landscape has recently gone under tremendous change. But as far as I'm concerned, and I spoke to people during the breaks and they seem to agree, we've had some fantastic guides for us over the day to help us to navigate this new landscape and determine what we're going to do over the years ahead. As well as all the speakers who have given their time, This seminar is only possible because of some people working behind the scenes, and this includes the seminar organising committee, and the organising committee include Darren Davis, Ken Lockery, Kathy Nance, Andrew Boll, Sarah Hodgkinson, Philip French and John Moroney. Also, the Institute staff helped us to organise the function, and we were very grateful to the Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees who allowed us to publicise this event through their network. So could we thank all those workers behind the scene?